Accession number 16252, Reel 3.
Brigadier Smallman, Reel 3.
With General Sir Walter Kirk, who was the security chief of ICI. They had, of course, a considerable number of factories, particularly in the north, and some of the work they were doing was of a highly secret nature, particularly their work on plastics. And so security was a problem, and Walter Kirk was responsible for the security arrangements. But he bare-led me round the ICI factories. And there was one particular evening in Darlington when he was wanting to don his uniform. Although he was a retired officer, he wanted to don his uniform for some sort of occasion. And up to that point, of course, he was used, as I was, to having a batman to do his polishing for him. So I volunteered to polish, and for once in a while I found myself polishing a full general's service dress uniform, buttons, brass and all. It was an interesting and a rewarding sort of thing to do, because one did feel that one was making some sort of contribution to the morale of the workforce, and many of whom, of course, and this is the point I was putting across to them, many of them were suffering from the air raids and the disruption caused by air raid warnings. They were constantly being herded into their shelters and out from their shelters, and they, in many cases, of course, they had suffered destruction in places like Glasgow, Birmingham, Coventry, and so on. And so one did feel one was making a real contribution. And when I came back from that particular exercise, I was told that I was wanted for a job at Combined Operations Headquarters, and as was Peter Young, and the two of us set off to become G2's plans, Combined Operations Headquarters at Richmond Terrace in London.
What did that involve for you?
Well, really it was a bit disappointing, because we found ourselves in a very high-level atmosphere of people in planning operations which most of us felt, were unlikely to come off. And it was really very remote from the sort of lively training that we were doing when we were up in Scotland. And Peter Young particularly, who was a very energetic soldier, he was very disappointed and immediately started making appeals to the CO, John Thomas Slater, to get back the 3 Commando. I was similarly disturbed, and fortunately, on the staircase one day, as I was going down to go out of the building, I met Brigadier Bob Laycock, who just got back from the Middle East, where he'd been involved, amongst other things, in the raid on Rommel's headquarters. And he stopped me in my tracks and asked me if I would like to become his brigade major. He'd been told by Charles Hayden, who was the previous brigadier of the SS Brigade, that I was staff trained, and I'd done a certain amount of operational staff work in both operations in Norway. And so he said, would I like to come and join him in Scotland as his brigade major? And I said, I'd be delighted. I joined him, first of all, in Castle Douglas, where brigade was. We moved then to Ardrossan, Seafield Towers in Ardrossan, and I found myself sitting there in a rather nice circular office in the tower of Seafield Towers, doing what I really enjoyed doing most, which is doing operation and planning staff work.
And then?
Well, most of it, of course, consisted of working while the brigadier was away, because things like the San Nazaire operation, the Dieppe operation, were being planned, and commandos were being sent off on those operations. And when the brigadier was away down in London doing the overall planning of those, I was happily up in Scotland doing my best to keep the thing going. One of the brigade staff, as liaison officer, was Evelyn Waugh, who'd come to us from the Royal Marines, from 8 Commando, had transferred to the Blues, because, of course, Bob Laycock was in the Blues, and he'd arranged transfer for Evelyn Waugh. Evelyn Waugh was a highly amusing sort of chap to have around the place, because he was most unmilitary in many ways. He had a puckish sense of humour. There was one occasion when he was duty officer in brigade headquarters, and a signal came from Mount Batten to the effect that he wanted to know by return. It was a personal signal to the brigade commander. He wanted to know by return what was the best way to get to our various establishments. And Evelyn Waugh sent a succinct reply, not very military, which he said more or less the effect that it depends where you start from, which I suppose is a logical answer. It didn't help Mountbatten very much in the problem that he had. And I still have a number of training notes written by Evelyn Waugh, which do display this very puckish touch, including a long article that he wrote for General de Gaulle, or one of General de Gaulle's officers, on the formation of the commandos. And the Frenchman then translated it into French and sent the French back to Evelyn to have a further look at. And Evelyn Waugh was rather astonished to find how remote from the truth the translation had become.
How did you get on with Waugh?
I got on with him very well, because if provided one treated him, not exactly as a bit of a joke, you had to treat him, you had to accept the fact that he would react to normal military discipline in a very undisciplined fashion. So you had to talk Evelyn Waugh into doing things rather than telling him to do something. If you told him to do something, he'd go away and do something entirely different if he felt that way inclined. No, I got on with him very well. He was a very interesting chap to watch, because you could see him observing. He clearly, and it comes out in the series of books he wrote about, partly about his time in the commandos, officers and gentlemen, that sort of thing. He would sit observing people, and you could see those rather staring eyes of his just looking around and watching. And you knew perfectly well that he was storing up the material for yet another book, like Put Out More Flags, which of course he produced at that time. And Put Out More Flags deals with a true life story of the days when 8 commando and 3 commando were embarking at Greenock on a vessel which had already got a unit on board, which had to be moved out. And whoever ordered the move out at the same time as 3 commando and 8 commando were embarking. And the chaos on the gangways had to be seen to be believed. And that's a thing which, an incident which appears in Put Out More Flags. The brigade commander, who was then the CO, Bob Laycock, of 8 commando, is reputed to have said to Evelyn Waugh, who was liaison officer, who was responsible for trying to get 8 commando into the ship, "You made a hell of a mess of that this time, didn't you?" Which is a bit unfair, because it wasn't his responsibility.
What about the Saint-Nazaire raid itself, which occurred at this time? Did you have anything to do with that?
I had nothing to do with that. I had a number of my friends were on the Saint-Nazaire raid and were killed. Because the Saint-Nazaire raid, although 2 commando was the unit basically sent, they did recruit a lot of officers from other commandos, particularly for demolition purposes, to take command of small demolition parties. And we had 2 officers from 3 commando, both of whom were killed, unfortunately, in the raid. So I just knew it was going on, and I knew when it was going to be and what it was, but I was not involved in that.
And the Dieppe raid, which is in August?
The Dieppe raid, there again, I wasn't directly involved, except in sending out movement orders and things of that kind. 3 commando, very much involved, and my chum Peter Young, of course, was one of the heroes of the Dieppe raid, because it was he leading a very depleted force, managed to keep a coast defense battery under control. He hadn't got enough troops to deal with it properly, but by pretending that he had more troops than he had and firing at the coast defense battery, he got the coast defense battery to fire back at him instead of firing out to sea. And for that, Peter Young got a DSO. But there again, I knew of the operation, but it was not anything to do with me.
And we're now coming on to the North Africa landings in November.
Yes, North Africa had been brewing as an idea when I was down in Combined Operations Headquarters, and I saw something of the early thinking on that. The SS Brigade then had to produce two commandos, one numbers one and six commando, under a chap called Glendinning, up at Dundee. And I was sent up to Dundee to be what amounted to brigade major of that force while the planning was completed. At that time, I knew that I would be going to the Staff College and therefore wouldn't be involved in Torch, but I was sent up to help in the planning. And we had with us, we had two chaps from the special boat section, a chap called Foote, and a chap called Courtney, who was the brother of Roger Courtney, the man who started the special boat section when he was with 8 Commando. And they were in Dundee. In fact, they were at the cinema. They were watching a film in the cinema. And I got a message from London over the Scrambler telephone to say they were wanted urgently down in London. Would I please get them on the night train from Dundee? So we had to put a message on the screens of the 3 or 4 cinemas in Dundee, asking them if they were there, please to report to Gate Headquarters at once, which they did. And we put them on the train. And their task, in fact, was to go to North Africa via a submarine with General Mark Clark and to land General Mark Clark on the North African coast for sub rosa discussions with the French, to ascertain whether the French, of course, would oppose the landing or not. And that's when the story goes that Mark Clark had a sneezing fit as they were going ashore in the foul boat from the submarine. And he had to be forcibly quietened, I gather. But that was quite a nice little story for them, to be watching a film in Dundee and finding themselves heading for North Africa the following day. But then after that, those two commandos went off to North Africa. In fact, they weren't properly used. Randolph Churchill went with them in my place as brigade major. But they weren't properly used. They were used more or less as normal infantry without any particular raiding task. But that is probably because there wasn't the proper task for them when they got there. And they never really did their proper function at all in North Africa. Meantime, I went off to the Staff College as a student. Alan Cunningham was the Staff College commandant, and I had just an interesting and instructive time as a student at Camberley.
That lasted till May 1943, I think.
Yeah, and in view then of my combined operations background, I had the rather nice posting of brigade major of 8 Infantry Brigade in 3rd Division, which was the assault division for Overlord.
Number 8?
8. 8 Infantry Brigade, yes. Which had, of course, been Monty's brigade at one time. He'd commanded 8 Infantry Brigade. He'd also, I don't think he'd been brigade major, I'm not sure. But that was up in Scotland, and I was responsible then for the brigade planning for Operation Overlord. My brigade commander was a chap called Cripps, B.U.S. Cripps, Bus Cripps, very good commander. The divisional commander was General Ramsden, who had been a corps commander of Montgomery's in North Africa and unfortunately had fallen out with Montgomery in North Africa. And so when Montgomery was appointed to take over in this country for Overlord, he replaced Ramsden with General Rennie. My brigade commander also went, so did I, because 8 Brigade was taken over by a Brigadier Copper Cass, who, the Duke of Wellington's, who wanted to bring his own brigade major with him. And that worked very smoothly. In some ways, I'm glad that I didn't, in fact, continue as brigade major of 8 Brigade, because 8 Brigade, in some ways, 8 Brigade had a very tough time ashore. They were blitzed when they got ashore overlord. They were landing at Wistreham, and it is debatable whether I would have survived, instead of which I went off to India, still with a combined operations label. I was sitting in Delhi, a hotel in Delhi, on my day off, the 4th of June, 1944, drinking iced coffee and listening to the BBC, and there wasn't a word about the landing in Normandy. And I'd gone to India knowing when I knew where the division was going to land, I knew where the brigade was going to land, I knew what the tasks of the battalions were, I knew the date. And I thought there'd been some tremendous cock-up, because there wasn't a cheap. Then, of course, I discovered that it had been postponed for 48 hours, which explained the whole thing. And my time in Delhi really consisted of just general operational matters, operational planning, and various briefings, writing sitreps. I was then sent down to Kandy, where the advance headquarters of what was then Allied Land Forces Southeast Asia were. And my task then was similar, but in addition, I did from time to time go over to Mountbatten's headquarters to give out the war room news. And that meant I was renewing an acquaintance, if one can call it that, with Mountbatten, who'd been chief of combined operations and whom I'd met when I was in Ardrossan with the brigade headquarters. He was a dynamic performer. I know he's come in for a certain amount of criticism, being egotistical and all that, but he was a dynamic commander, an extremely able chairman of a planning committee, very quick to notice if one faltered when giving out the news, for example, in his war room. He had this wonderful war room with maps that slid in from the side, made up of the various theatres of operations. He had an ex-Disney animator who prepared little plastic stick-on things to put on the map. So, for example, if one talked about elephants, he would have little elephants stuck on the map to show where the elephants were. And of course, the elephant bill was working behind the scenes in Burma at that time, so there were a lot of elephants appearing. But if I happened to say that the 3rd, 4th, whatever, were 3.5 miles southwest of Sitang on the such and such track, and he didn't realize they're on that track at all, he would stop me in my tracks myself and say, how come yesterday there was no mention of their being there? I thought they were back in such and such. And he was right. He had a very, very accurate, and retentive memory. And, of course, he was a very colourful person altogether. He didn't get on with Vinegar Joe Stilwell, who was his deputy, the American. And when Mountbatten went into the jungle to chat up the troops, the occasion particularly when he was injured because he had a splinter of bamboo in his eye, but that occasion he asked Vinegar Joe to come and to fly in from his own headquarters to be at Kandy, because there was quite a bit of planning going on and he wanted his deputy to be there. But Joe Stilwell wouldn't. He would not come anywhere near what he called the fleshpots of Kandy. Another interesting visitor was Carton de Wart, who was a very colourful character, Carton de Wart. He was our man in Chungking, and he used to come from time to time to the headquarters. And, of course, the sight of him with the patch on his eye and one arm, and knowing full well how many times he'd been wounded, was quite a thing. But again, he was one of those people who, very quick, and his briefings on his relationship with Chiang Kai-shek and his relationship with the Chinese were always very much to the point and very well put over. Impressive man. Polish extraction.
In what way were they both colourful, apart from...
Because, really, colourful, I think, was his appearance. He was flamboyant. And, he was rather like Mountbatten. You had the feeling that here is a born leader. And our friend Peter Young, you see, had the same thing. This is what led him to start up the sealed knot. He was a historian. He was particularly interested in the Civil War. He saw himself as a laughing cavalier, and he had a moustache that went with this image of the laughing cavalier. And he treated his soldiers in the way that he felt, and the soldiers loved him, but he treated soldiers as he felt the way that a cavalier gentleman would treat his soldiers. You dogs, you know, this sort of thing, but on the other hand, they loved him for it.
So, you put here that you went to Imphal?
Well, that was just a fly-in from Delhi when Imphal was surrounded. Nothing really happened there. It was just that Imphal was surrounded by the Japanese, and we had umpteen divisions. I think we had about five divisions in Imphal, and I flew in to fill in a gap as a spare staff officer for a time. But the interesting thing about that particular experience was the number of divisions we had on the plain of Imphal, where incidentally polo was invented, but nobody was playing polo at that time.
Now, we come on next, I think, to the planning of other operations.
Yes.
Operation Roger, what was that?
That was 34 Corps headquarters was set up. General Uvrey Roberts was withdrawn from Burma to set up a new corps, 34 Indian Corps, to do, at that time, to plan for Operation Roger, with a view to later planning for the reinvasion of Malaya. And the headquarters was formed in Delhi. And again, combined operations background, I was whisked up there at General Roberts' request to be G2 Ops. Roger was an operation to take the little island of Phuke off the coast of Siam. And the story goes that Mountbatten, who didn't want Wrens going around asking for the plans of this particular operation and mispronouncing its name, so he insisted that it was pronounced Phuke, and at the same time he insisted on calling it Operation Roger, which delighted everybody. It was going to be the invasion of this island to provide an airbase for further operations down the coast for the retaking of Malaya. Our chief engineer worked out from the map that the length of road at that time in the island was exceeded by the nose-to-tail length of the vehicles that we were aiming to put ashore.
And Operation Zipper... Have to go into Malaya.
That's right. Operation Zipper, which was called... Mountbatten said it was called Zipper because nothing was buttoned up. It was the operation to retake Malaya from the Japanese. And we were all set. Everything was planned to land on the Morib beaches. But, of course, the atom bomb was dropped in the meantime. We were embarked in Bombay, off Bombay, and the force was due to sail direct to the Morib beaches. But as soon as the bomb was dropped and it was clear that the Japanese were giving in, part of the force had to be diverted to Penang. The commando brigade, which was supposed to be landing, which had been operating in Burma, it had to be diverted to Hong Kong. And only part of the force landed on the Morib beaches, the headquarters and part of the force. We had an unopposed landing. We were landed on beaches. It would have been a wet landing because, unfortunately, the beach reconnaissance wasn't as good as the beach reconnaissance for Normandy. And we were landed in about 4 to 5 feet of water, which was a bit disconcerting. We were taking tanks ashore, but the tanks would have been found it very difficult to operate. The Japanese had not maintained the malarial, anti-malarial ditches in the rubber plantations, and movement across country for tanks would have been very heavy going. So really, it would have been a difficult operation, and it was a joy to us, the chaps who planned it, to find that we weren't facing the Japanese actively. The plan was, after getting ashore there, a series of combined operational hooks down the coast to Singapore with the final taking of Singapore. And there is no doubt about it, from my point of view, the experience out there and seeing what the operation would have entailed, we would have had very severe losses, quite apart from the losses the Americans might well have suffered in going for the mainland of Japan. We would have had very severe losses if it hadn't been for the dropping of the atom bomb. And, you know, putting all the moral issues on one side, that is a straightforward statement of my point of view. We would have suffered. As it was, the Japanese bent over backwards, of course. In fact, the Japanese commander in Malaya had to make a signal to Mountbatten saying, if you tell me where my troops are, I will make quite certain that they give in, because they were so scattered and they'd been so disturbed in South Burma by the British moving down to Rangoon that the Japanese had more or less lost touch with that bit of it. They were absolutely on top of the forces in Malaya, but in South Burma they were very hazy. We very quickly formed them into, disarmed them, and formed them into camps. And we had when I was later going up into North Malaya, we had a very large camp up in the area of Kolakangsa. We had Japanese working parties working for our headquarters, and they worked very well, because, of course, they're face-saving, they had to work well. We had, of course, Japanese troops in Java and Sumatra, commanded by armed Japanese troops, commanded by British officers, because of the threat of troubles in what had been the Dutch East Indies. And so we sent troops over from, we sent British officers over from 34 Corps headquarters to, including our CRA, the chief gunner, went across to command a particular bunch of Japanese. And the report was that their police work was absolutely excellent. So one's got to hand it to Japanese discipline. I can remember an occasion later when a working party of Japanese at our brigade headquarters in Kolakangsa was seen by the brigade commander playing cards underneath one of the buildings when they're supposed to be cutting the grass. He told the Japanese commander, who promptly went round and slapped the faces of the whole lot of them, just like that, which is the sort of thing, of course, they were doing to our own prisoners of war. So to some extent you can see why they behaved so ruthlessly with prisoners of war. Not that that excuses it, but to some extent you can see what is built into their character. Yeah, well, from the Moree beaches, we advanced up to Kuala Lumpur, where we to set up our Corps headquarters in the Victoria Institute in Kuala Lumpur. And we had the problem, of course, of dealing with there was quite a bit of looting going on. There were looting depots and things, and we had to deal with, again, a refugee problem of people coming out of Kuala Lumpur fearing there was going to be fighting because they hadn't got the full news of the peaceful occupation. So going up to Kuala Lumpur, we were met with people carrying furniture from the railway depots, for example, and this sort of thing, and carts of loads of people on their way down. And we had to stop and tell them that it's all right with the British, but the Japanese are giving in and it's going to be...